It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll look at the dark side of fraternities and what colleges are doing or not doing about them.
First, tomorrow is International Women's Day, an opportunity to take stock on how far we've come on women's rights and consider what's next.
Today, according to the World Health Organization, more than 1 in 3 women in the world will be physically or sexually abused in her lifetime, with that number reaching as high as 70% in some countries.
As we mark this year's International Women's Day, the International Violence Against Women Act is being considered by Congress. It would make gender-based abuse a permanent part of United States efforts abroad.
Our next guest, Ritu Sharma, has played a role in developing that legislation. She's the president and co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide. She's here with us now. Ritu, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
So first, when did we start marking International Women's Day?
105 years ago, believe it or not. I know a lot of people are just hearing about it for the first time, and this is the first time ever we got a Google Doodle on International Women's Day, so that was a breakthrough. But it's actually been a holiday that's been around for a long time, and the point of it is to just recognize the incredible contributions that women have made to history, to science, to business, to literature, and all around the world. It's a big celebration. Women take a lot of pride in celebrating this day.
Well, before we get into the legislation you've been working on, what particular things would you like to mark to celebrate on International Women's Day?
Well, a couple things to celebrate. More girls are in school around the world than ever before in human history. More kids are living beyond the age 5 than ever before. Women's life expectancy around the world has increased. So I know there are a lot of horror stories that we hear, a lot of information out there about violence and abuse, and it's all real. But the backdrop to this is that women around the world are making progress. They are getting it done for themselves. They're not waiting around for people to help them out. They're taking matters into their own hands, and they are breaking barriers all over the place.
Well, part of your effort is to try, at least to some extent, to have the United States help women out around the world with the International Violence Against Women Act. What's the story behind the act and what it would do?
So for many years, you're familiar with the Violence Against Women Act, the domestic legislation that created numerous programs to help women with violence in the United States. The International Violence Against Women Act is essentially the sister bill. And what it would do is make eliminating violence against women and girls a specific goal of U.S. foreign policy. And what that means is that when we are dealing with countries, for example, let's take Papua New Guinea, where the violence against women rate is 98%. Part of the culture, or countries in Africa where female genital mutilation is practiced, you know, on 80% of the girls. These are the kinds of things that our diplomats and our development people overseas will have to start engaging these governments around because it's an express goal of U.S. foreign policy to do so.
You know, even in a country that maybe acknowledges this as a problem, might there be some pushback against a sense the United States is interfering in something that they would prefer to solve themselves?
Yes, and I think that in many cases is a ruse, because when the U.S. is engaging these other countries on, say, economic policy or democratization, you don't necessarily get that pushback. But when it comes to women's rights, you know, the reality is that there's a lot of guys in power that really like it the way that it is. And the truth is that there are women in these countries, and many men as well, who are trying to push from inside. They are working within their own cultures, within their own communities. And what this does is it sends a signal to all of those people at the grassroots level that are trying to change their country from within that the United States is standing with them. And that gives them a huge lift. Will it annoy some people? Sure. But when it comes to human rights issues around the world, the United States pretty routinely annoys other countries because we press the issue of human rights.
Is this something that would just be symbolic words in the State Department's mission, or are there real incentives and punishments, or rewards or negative consequences in this legislation for other countries?
Yeah, a couple interesting things have already happened. And one is that what this legislation would do is it would mandate that the U.S. government have a strategy, but then it actually pick five countries where the government wants to do something about violence and where the incidence of it is high. And that's a carrot. You know, what we're saying is that to a government, you know, we can give you $100 million to deal with this problem. And not only that, it will strengthen your relationships with the United States. It'll strengthen our economic ties. So we're holding out there some carrots, and that's a good thing. In terms of the stick part of it, the opposite is true as well. You know, when we're engaging with countries to give them aid dollars, this is going to be one of the things that we'll be talking about. And, you know, it's implied that if the government feels that this is just not something that they want to address, what this bill says is, look, violence against women is an economic issue. You know, it's an education issue. You know, if the U.S. is going to invest in your education system and you're not going to deal with violence against girls, we don't think our money is going to be very effective in your country. So if this bill passes, it will make, you know, violence part of the fabric of what we're doing with countries around the world. And so, yeah, does it have teeth? Absolutely.
Has there been opposition to your legislation, your proposed legislation in Congress?
No, there has not been opposition. I have yet to see a member of Congress get up and say, although it's in the realm of possibility, you know, I support violence against women and girls. No one has yet done that.
Well, I've seen arguments not from people in Congress, but that this is a stealth way to promote birth control or abortion around the world. That's at least one argument I've seen from conservative critics of the legislation.
Yeah, that's not correct, actually. The bill would not fund anything to do with abortion. The money for this bill goes to the International Affairs Committee, and there's already a blanket prohibition on abortion activities. So there is no chance that this could support abortion-related activities overseas. I think when you peel back, you know, what's really behind that effort, I think there's other things going on, which more has to do with kind of wanting to keep women in their place and keep things as they are. It's not about abortion. So no, is there any real issue around this bill? Not at all. I think what we need to do is raise the momentum so it will get put on a very busy congressional agenda. Now, we already have 9 Republican co-sponsors in the House, and we've got 2-3 Republican co-sponsors coming on in the Senate. Now, this is a very, very bipartisan issue. And for all of those who are going to be going back home and trying to court women to vote for them, there's something in it for the members of Congress who come on to Iowa.
When I hear numbers like some countries where 70% of women are physically and or sexually abused, 98%, you said in another place, it seems like this bill in the United States might help, but it can only be part of a solution. What's the most important thing that needs to change to make those numbers go way down?
Well, the most important thing to do is to really engage men and women at the community level. Community level programs that help people to start thinking differently. But we can do it. We've done it with HIV/AIDS around the world. We have succeeded at getting people to change their behavior around a very sensitive issue of sex. And we can sponsor those kinds of programs as well to really reduce violence against women and girls. We know that they work. It's really a matter of investing in them.
Ritu, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy International Women's Day.
And to you as well. We've been speaking with Ritu Sharma, president and co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide. She helped develop the International Violence Against Women Act, currently being considered by Congress.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with WPR news guy Noah Ovshinsky about the top state news stories of the week.
First, we take a look at fraternities and modern frat life. You might think of the parties, the socializing, and the networking, but our next guest says there's a dark side of fraternities. She spent the last year investigating the world of frats, including a look at some of the tragic events that happen at these houses.
Our guest says it can be hard to hold fraternities accountable because many have actually become more powerful than the colleges and universities that house them.
Joining us now is Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor to The Atlantic. Her piece, The Dark Power of Fraternities, is this month's cover story, and we've got a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you spent the last year looking into the world of social fraternities, and I want to start by reading something you wrote. You wrote, "When there's a common denominator among hundreds of such injuries and deaths, one that exists across all kinds of campuses, from private to public, prestigious to obscure, then it is more than newsworthy. It begins to approach a national scandal." So, how big a national issue are the deaths and injuries of fraternities?
Well, when you think about the context in which they occur, which is college life, which shouldn't be by its very nature a very dangerous thing, if we were talking about young people who were in emergency services or who were in the military or something like that, we would certainly expect that there would be a great amount of consequent injury and even death. But this is very different. This is mothers and fathers who have saved money for many years, kids taking huge loans, going off to this kind of ennobling experience of education. And to see so many of these kids ending up dead, since 2006, some 60 kids have died in fraternity-related incidents, which is a tiny fraction of the number who have been seriously injured or sexually assaulted or otherwise harmed by it, then it becomes a very shocking kind of situation and something that's so old and that we've all gotten so used to that we tend not to think of it as a national scandal, but I think people from outside of our country are certainly shocked by it, and I think we ought to give it a second thought as well.
What kind of patterns did you see as you looked at the assaults, the deaths, the hazings that are happening at fraternities?
I spent a lot of time looking at the internal documents that are produced by the fraternity industry, particularly regarding their liability when these incidents happened. And what one thing I was certain of, incorrectly, was that the most common kind of injury would be from hazing, because that's what we always hear about. That's the great danger when you join a frat, that your brothers will haze you. In fact, hazing is the least common kind of reported injury at a fraternity. Number one is assault and battery. Kids get liquored up and they fight. There's a kid who was entered into a coma last week. He's still in a coma in Pennsylvania. Some boys, young men, were fighting at his frat. He broke up the fight. He got roundhouse punched, hit the ground hard on his head, and he's now in a coma. So that's the number one form of reported injury. Number two is sexual assault. The number two kind of insurance claim made against American fraternities is sexual assault of young women by men either belonging to the fraternity or guests of the fraternity, and that's some 15% of all injuries. So that's a significant number in itself. So I was sort of surprised by the variety and kinds of crime that, or rather of incidents, some of them criminal, that are far more prevalent than the hazing.
Now, I think when we think of the incidences you talk about, we assume, true or false, that it's probably got alcohol involvement somewhere at its root. How true is that when we assume that about fraternities and all the incidences you're talking about?
It's very, I looked at hundreds of incidents in the course of writing this essay, and alcohol, extreme alcohol use, was at the center, really, of every single one. What happened, as you remember, in the mid-80s, the uniform drinking age in all 50 states went up to age 21. It had been lowered at the time of Vietnam. Many states were 18 or 19. The idea was if you're old enough to fight in that war, you're old enough to get to buy a beer. And then in the mid-80s, peacetime, the drinking age changed. And what that did was it really changed the nature of drinking on campus, that it pushed all drinking off campus. It pushed a huge amount of drinking out of bars, where at least there's some monitoring of, if not of IDs, then of the amount that you drink. It pushed it off campus, and to an incredible extent, it pushed it into the fraternity houses, which have formal systems for the service of alcohol. So when you look at if there were a Venn diagram of the extreme binge drinking problem in colleges of America and the fraternity drinking problem, there's a pretty big overlap. Not all collegiate binge drinking by any stretch of the imagination is taking place in fraternities, but a large amount of it is, and a huge amount of consequent accidents and trauma occurs as a result.
Now, the fraternities themselves, as you paint them in your piece, seem incredibly well protected from litigation. They have systems in place for minimizing any sort of damage to the fraternities themselves and any sort of action that could be taken at a broad level. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about some of those systems and how they work?
Well, what happens when you join a fraternity, the most expensive part of your membership dues are for the fraternity insurance. They're not broken out as a separate line item, but they do explain that chapter by chapter the insurance is more or less depending on previous incidents over the last few years. So mom and dad back home might be a little anxious about this fraternity membership knowing that there are so many fraternity-related lawsuits, but they think to themselves, well, we have paid all this money for the fraternity insurance, so if he does become a named defendant in a lawsuit, that will pay out his claim. In fact, the fraternities use the insurance in a different way. That insurance that the young man paid for, in effect, it protects the national fraternity from the individual actions of the members. So that if a member is at the fraternity house one night and something terrible happens, upstairs a kid drinks himself to death, or a young woman is assaulted, or there's a dangerous event that happens, if that family's son was at the fraternity house breaking any rule at all, having one beer under the age of 21, for example, breaking any risk management policy, he can be instantly dropped from that fraternity insurance. It's not going to protect him. It's going to protect the national. Now, who's going to pay the claims against him? And I think this may be the most shocking part of my investigation for parents. The claims against that individual 18, 19, 20-year-old member get paid out of his parents' homeowner's insurance. And beyond that, if that individual member needs a legal defense, because there are no public defenders in civil litigation, mom and dad pay for that as well.
And you write at one point in your piece that if a young man is involved in an incident where the fraternity sort of gets shut down, they're waiting for the national people from the organization to step in, you think the best thing for them to do is get out of the house and call their own lawyer.
Yeah, what happens is, the kids are told, look, if a serious incident happens, the good news is they're told to be completely honest with the emergency personnel, completely honest with the cops, to call all the other members back to the house to get rid of all the guests and to immediately call the national hotline for the fraternity. And that indeed someone from the national office, if it's a serious incident, will be flying out to talk to them. And these young men assume incorrectly, and if they read the paperwork more carefully, they'd understand it, but they're many times young and they don't get it, they assume this guy from the National is going to come and help us. And he gives them lots of questionnaires, and they fill them out, explaining exactly what happened and where they were, thinking, ah, good, here's this organization that I've pledged fealty to. They're here to help me. Not at all. All those questionnaires and all that investigating that happens in the chapter in the immediate hours afterwards will probably be used against the individual members by the national fraternity and can leave them hanging out to dry. So I would absolutely recommend if a young man is a member of a fraternity, if something goes wrong that night, don't sit around and wait for the folks from national to come. I would say go back to your dorm room, call your parents, tell them what's happened, and investigate the possibility of getting your own lawyer, because the fraternity's not on your side in that situation.
And what the fraternities themselves seem to be saying about all this is that it's a few bad eggs giving fraternities a bad name, that these are extreme situations, and in fact, lots of parents want their sons to be in fraternities because there are job connections, because they think fraternities foster civic engagement and growing men who will be responsible and contributing to society. What do you think about the bad egg argument?
Well, when fraternity is done right, it is a tremendous advantage to a young man. It really, in these tough economic times, that fraternity membership can supercharge a degree. You might be going to some, you know, somewhat regional institution in a part of the country that doesn't have a lot of connections to, say, investment banking or national politics or big-time law firms. But now you've joined a club for a relatively small amount of money that gives you an instant network to a huge, vast array of people all over the country and very largely represented in the fraternity powerhouse fields of business, politics, and law. And moreover, there's tremendous service opportunities, And again, when fraternity is done right, the opportunities for leadership are probably unequaled, because those young men are running their chapter. They probably have a budget of $500,000 a year. There isn't some grown-up supervisor telling them how to do it. They have to make the budget work. They have to make risk management policies line up. And so fraternity men tend to graduate with really exceptional abilities in terms of leadership and management that, again, they bought for pennies on the dollar, in a sense, for compared to having gone to get an MBA or some other degree that explicitly teaches you that kind of leadership.
We're talking right now with Caitlin Flanagan about her piece, The Dark Side of Fraternities.
You can join the conversation. Are you in a fraternity, or have you been in one in the past? What do you make of this? Do you think colleges and universities have a moral obligation to address problems at fraternities? Do you think the benefits outweigh the problems? What do you think needs to change, if anything? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on our Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor to The Atlantic, about her recent piece on fraternities and their role on college campuses and the sometimes dark side and tragic events that happen there. You can join the conversation. Are you a fraternity member, or have you been? Or are you a college or university administrator? A parent, maybe. Would you want your son to join a fraternity? Call in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Caitlin, I want to dig into a little bit of the relationship between fraternities and colleges. Now, originally, it sounds like fraternities wanted to be independent from colleges, and the whole point was to assert that independence. And now there seems to be this sort of symbiotic relationship going on that may not serve either to the best effect. Can you tell us a little bit about how they're intertwined these days?
Well, the relationship certainly serves the fraternities very well. You know, if you think of every college and university in the country that has a fraternity system, has an office of Greek life. Oftentimes, if it's a big school, it's a very well-staffed office. If it's a public university, you and I are paying for that. So you have to remember that fraternities are largely subsidized by public dollars, in addition to their various aspects that are not have nonprofit status. So fraternities get a lot from their university connection. They get a lot of advertising and promotion. If you go onto any, you know, university that has a Greek system, you'll just click on and see a whole website there run by the university describing and promoting its different frats. The side of the equation that has less to gain from it, in a certain sense, is the university, because when there's bad behavior, it reflects badly on the university, and they may be named defendants in the lawsuit, although they often won't pay out on that. But in a sense, the university really needs the fraternities far more than the fraternities need the university. The fraternities provide a lot of fundraising. They provide a huge amount of social programming and make colleges more attractive to students when colleges are competing for student enrollment. And finally, the fraternities provide a tremendous amount of housing for American undergraduates. One out of every eight students in a residential college in America lives in Greek housing. So that's this huge amount of housing that colleges don't have to pay for, they don't have to build, insure, or maintain. So really, in many substantive ways, the fraternities have the upper hand in that relationship.
So what needs to change, then, in the way that colleges and fraternities interact?
You know, people often ask me that, and I one of the points of my essay is to say that it's quite naive to imagine that anything will really change. Remember that these young men have a constitutionally granted right to the freedom of association. It's an implied right from the freedom of assembly. So these young men have every right to belong to a private society that is conducted in privately owned house on privately held land. So the idea that the university has an ability to tell them they can't belong to that is inaccurate. Now, if it's a private college, they could potentially limit, say, that you can't belong to a fraternity. But again, their private colleges are loath to infringe upon the constitutional rights of their students. So while fraternities are always changing and perhaps trying to improve their risk profile, I can't really envision, people will often, ever since I've written this, there's been all this writing and commentary about ways it could reform the system and the relationship. I think when you look at that constitutional nature of the rights of the young men who belong to it, it would be very difficult and perhaps not even, and I don't think it would be the right thing to do to infringe upon those rights, unless, again, it's a private college, in which case you can do whatever, you can legislate any kind of private behavior and you can violate any kind of right.
Let's get our callers in on this. We've got Zachary with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Zachary.
Hi.
Hi, what is your take on fraternities?
I just wanted to share, I was intrigued by the prompt because not only am I an alumni of a fraternity here in Wisconsin, but I recently received my master's in higher education and now am an administrator at a university in Wisconsin, and have definitely been able to see both sides of the coin, and kind of in my hindsight and in my education really seen some of the detrimental things that can happen in these organizations when they're not overseen by the administration and when kind of control from the university gets kind of loose. The organization I was in college was a local organization. And so unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of the benefits that really draws people to Greek life, like the wide networking and budgetary and financial resources. But the things that I really took away from that experience were a lot of those transferable skills, though, just for my career and for my life, you know, those interpersonal skills and the ability to, like you said before, manage my own resources after having overseen a budget for a student organization like that. I think what was most helpful at our university was the fact that they really treated Greek life like any other student organization and expected certain programming on campus, certain involvement in the community that really made us feel like we were more than our traditions and our secrets, but really got us.
Okay, Zachary, thank you so much for all your thoughts about your fraternity experience. And Caitlin, what about the case Zachary's making there?
Well, it's interesting when he talks about control by the university or the administration of the fraternities, and if there were more of that, the fraternity experience would be improved. What's interesting is that the universities and colleges do not want to exert more control over the fraternities for the following reason. The more that you get involved in monitoring the behavior on the frats, the more you establish your own duty of care and the more you become liable for something that goes wrong. So if the university gets deeply involved in saying, when you have a party, you have to do this, this, and this, and we need all this pre-information about your party, there's a little bit of it now, but if you really get into carefully monitoring the behavior to make them safer, well, then you've taken on the responsibility, the right to monitor, you take on the responsibility when something goes wrong. So this is one of the first things people will suggest is let's get administrations at college and universities more involved with the fraternities, and that'll improve the system. You get to the attorneys for the college and university, they'll say, nothing doing. We don't want to expose ourselves to that liability. So the university has perhaps a morally suspect but a legally very wise impetus to not get involved in monitoring that behavior. So that's another aspect of the tension where people will say, oh, this problem can be easily solved. Really can't be easily solved.
And, you know, we've been talking big picture on fraternities. I wonder if you could zoom in now and talk in particular about one of the stories that you tell in your piece. And this is a story about an incident at Wesleyan University. Could you tell us what happened there?
Well, this was a typical case that just shows how much power fraternities have in terms of their alumni. You know, Wesleyan University in Connecticut is a very elite, very small, it's really more of a private college than a private university. There's only, I think, fewer than 3,000 undergraduates, but they do offer graduate degrees. Anyways, one of their fraternities, Beta Theta Pi, had been very out of control for a very long time, lost its affiliation with the university, but Wesleyan kids were still going and partying there and getting into all kinds of dangerous situations. University, again, decides to do something it would come to regret, which is establish a duty of care by warning everybody. They sent an email to all the students and to all the students' parents saying, we're not affiliated with Beta Theta Pi. We don't want you to go there. It's not safe. We can't protect you if you're there. As strong a warning as you could imagine. And they were right to send it. It was a dangerous place. Well, immediately the 37 parents of the members went ballistic and wrote to the president, you've maligned our sons. They're about to enter the job market. You've called their moral character into question. And so when the new students arrived on campus that fall, Nothing had changed at Beta Theta Pi. Wasn't any safer. But the university decided, we're not going to send that email out to the freshmen. Those parents went nuts the last time we did it. Well, it wasn't 2 months into the school year before a young freshman, 18 years old, wanders over there, gets violently raped at a party, and ended up filing a very well-considered lawsuit saying that her Title IX rights had been violated because she hadn't received that warning. So for universities, anytime you play fast or loose with the fraternities, it's really going to come to serious matters. So it's very, very hard for college administrations to know what the right thing to do is. If you warn students, you get in trouble with one set of constituents. If you don't warn students, you can expose them to serious risk. So that was a real case in point of how this whole dynamic between institution and fraternity really plays out.
And we'll have to leave it there. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Caitlin Flanagan, a contributing editor at The Atlantic. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigation led a federal law enforcement agency to have to defend itself before Congress in recent weeks. We'll hear what went wrong with the ATF in Wisconsin.
But first, it's time for our weekly state news roundup with WPR's assistant news director, Noah Oshinsky.
No, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Well, let's kick off with an issue we've been covering on the show, you've been covering in the news department over the course of the week, an effort to change Wisconsin's educational standards. It's in the legislature. We heard from Senator Paul Farrow, a sponsor of this legislation. We heard from Department of Public Instruction Chief Tony Evers, a strong critic of that legislation. First, give us a little background, if you would, Noah, on what this does.
Yeah, so this bill basically scraps the Common Core Education Standards, which were developed about 4 years ago and adopted by 40-plus states, including Wisconsin. And the bill also then establishes a board of appointees here in Wisconsin that would come up with those standards instead of those put forth by the Common Core Standards.
So what's happened in the last couple days? A lot of new developments on this.
Right. So there's a public hearing this week, which drew a very large crowd of people, school district administrators, teachers, and people from the business community who don't like this bill and for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what did they have to say? What were some of the comments we were hearing at this public hearing yesterday?
Well, the state superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers, said on this show, in fact, that this proposed academic standards board would lead to the politicization of education standards. District superintendents have also echoed similar concerns. So, of course, there is this concern that this board, which would be made up of individuals appointed by the legislature, the governor, and the state superintendent, that they may eventually pass standards that may be not appropriate for students.
And Senator Farrow said, hey, this is just an opportunity to Wisconsinify. He didn't use that word.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
To make it local, to meet the needs of Wisconsin. Well, we've had this public hearing now, a lot of comment back and forth. Where does this legislation stand now?
Well, Senator Luther Olson, who's the chairman of the Education Committee, who's basically in charge of this bill, told the AP that the bill is – while it's not dead, it's basically in limbo. Basically, there just aren't enough votes, in particular Republican votes, at this point to pass this thing.
And we're so close to the end of the session, right, that if it's not moving and moving fast now, it's not going to happen for the time being.
Yeah. And, for me, this issue is really a question of how involved the legislature should be in what gets taught in the classroom. And I think that's a fundamental question that people disagree on, both school administrators, obviously some lawmakers who feel the legislature should be involved. The bill's chief backer, Senator Vukmir, has said that she hasn't given up on this. So we may see this again.
So it's in limbo. It is not dead.
Yeah, it's probably going to return in some form or another.
And next, we're going to move to a new proposal that could connect Superior to Alberta, Canada. There is a proposed pipeline in the works. Noah, what's going on there?
Right. So Enbridge, which is a large pipeline operator here in the United States and Canada, announced this week that they wanted to build a really large pipeline between Alberta, Canada, and Superior up in northern Wisconsin. In fact, this would be the largest single project that they have ever taken on, which is saying something because they operate a lot of pipelines.
And we've seen what kind of pushback there's been on the Keystone XL pipeline, which is still in limbo. What kind of hurdles would Enbridge have to clear to make this happen?
Well, that's an interesting thing with this particular pipeline that we're talking about. Enbridge argues that this project, the $7 billion project, is actually a replacement for an already existing line. So it doesn't need what's called a presidential permit from the Obama administration. And it's actually the pursuit of that permit which has the Keystone XL pipeline in limbo right now. We're waiting to get word from the State Department as to its future here in the United States. So if you know what Enbridge says is true, that in fact, because this pipeline is a replacement and not a new pipeline, then that's one less gigantic obstacle that Enbridge has to face in order to build this new infrastructure.
So this could be fast-tracked and not face the same hurdles that Keystone is facing.
Exactly. And of course, there are people out there, environmentalists, who argue, you know, actually, no, this thing should go through the same permitting process. So there is some disagreement there.
Now, this looks like a pretty big investment in the billions of dollars. Do you have a sense of the urgency for it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first read this, I think this is one of those stories that represents a much larger, much bigger story. I think that the fact that Enbridge is willing to invest this kind of money just says that it suggests how much oil is flowing from Canada both now and what they expect to flow in the near future, and certainly the importance of being able to transport that oil. I mean, right now, the United States and Canada is going through something of a fossil fuel renaissance right now. We are producing a lot of oil and natural gas. And, you know, how we choose to move these new resources is a matter of debate.
And environmentalists have a lot of concerns about the safety, about the transit, about leaks in the pipeline. I'm assuming that this new proposed Enbridge pipeline is facing that same kind of scrutiny. What are people saying about safety?
Right. So, you know, the news of this new proposal from Enbridge comes at a time when the transport of this oil is really under the microscope, both because there is an ever-increasing reliance on rail, which has raised some safety concerns. There are a lot more trains carrying oil through communities. And because there are, of course, there are those ever-present concerns about the safety of pipelines, especially here in the upper Midwest, because there was a spill in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan several years ago. It was an Enbridge pipeline that ruptured, and really a lot of oil ended up in that river. Environmentalists point to that as one of the many reasons why we shouldn't be investing more in these pipelines.
And you mentioned that we seem to be in the midst of a fossil fuel renaissance. Is that something that is getting this new proposal some pushback as well?
Right. Environmentalists, obviously, they compare it to the Keystone Pipeline, both because they think it's unsafe, and as I just mentioned, point to the Kalamazoo River example as an example, but because they feel like for every dollar that we're investing in new pipelines, that's money, that's resources, that's time that we're not spending moving the country, away from fossil fuels and towards green energy. Environmentalists look at these pipelines, both the Keystone Pipeline and the one we're just talking about from Enbridge here. They see this as delaying this transformation that they see needs to happen in this country.
And in terms of supporters for pipelines like this, there is, I suppose, the argument that this is not foreign oil.
Right, exactly. So supporters of the industry, including Governor Walker, who's very vocal in support of the Keystone Pipeline, argues that, this Canadian oil, as well as the oil that's coming from the Dakotas here in the U.S., that it will help the U.S. become less reliant on oil from regions that may be volatile or hostile. For the supporters of pipelines, this is about energy security.
No, it's early, but is there a timeline for this thing?
It is early. There, of course, may be opposition. It's still an open question as to whether or not this new pipeline has to go through the same process as Keystone. But Enbridge wants this new line operational by mid-2017.
Another big story this week came out over the weekend and progressed very quickly, a change in one leadership position among Republicans in the Assembly.
Yeah, so Republicans in the Assembly voted earlier this week to remove Representative Bill Cramer as majority leader for the rest of this session. And that happened just a few days after allegations surfaced that Cramer sexually harassed two women on a trip to Washington, D.C.
One voice we have not heard much from in this story is Representative Cramer himself. What's the latest we know about him?
Well, according to his office, he admitted himself, I believe it was last Saturday, he admitted himself to an unidentified treatment center.
And beyond the allegations of harassment, what did we know about Representative Bill Cramer before this?
Yeah, so he's one of those individuals in the Capitol who is really one of those sort of bigger personalities in the state Capitol. He's been described as bombastic, blunt. He's known for his sometimes inappropriate sense of humor. And one of the other things that I remember clearly was last year he walked out of the State of the Tribes address last year because he didn't like what he heard. And so certainly a big personality, forgetting everything else that may or may not be related to the allegations.
And again, before these allegations, was there a buzz about his personality around the Capitol, maybe even among his fellow Republicans?
Yeah, there were at least one lawmaker, if not more, who expressed during the election, the original election, for him to become the majority leader. There were concerns at around that same time that his past behavior, you know, may be problematic for the Republican caucus and for Cramer himself. So this, you know, these rumors of inappropriate behavior, in this case, allegations most recently, this isn't new.
He's out. Who is in the majority leader position?
So, yeah, Representative Pat Strakota was elected to replace Cramer, and notable for two reasons. One is she's the state assembly's first ever female majority leader. So that's a big deal. On the other side, though, she's leaving the legislature at the end of the session. So this new role itself is going to be short term.
So they didn't want a big rigmarole now. They'll elect somebody new after the next round of elections.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then any thoughts from Republicans as to Cramer's future, not in the leadership position, but in the assembly as a whole?
Right. So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said, you know, there are no plans to censure Representative Cramer. Cramer, as far as we know, you know, he hasn't resigned or anything like that. Voss did say that he hoped Cramer would not seek reelection. He did say if Cramer did come back to the legislature that, and again, he was a little bit vague about this, but he said, Voss said that actions would have to be taken to protect the safety of staff, lobbyists, and others at the Capitol.
Not something you ever want to have to say about one of your fellow caucus members.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and we'll wrap up with a look ahead. Can you give us a check on how the current session is shaping up?
Right. So we are very quickly closing in on the first week of April, which is the last week of the regularly scheduled session. So the legislative session is wrapping up. I would expect really a flurry of activity in the coming weeks up until that first week in April when the lawmakers are going to want to try to pass as much as they can before then.
All right. So they'll be keeping you busy.
Very.
All right. Noah, thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director.